On this week's 51%, ties to FDR. First, a woman pens a memoir about her polio and kinship with Franklin Roosevelt.
To identify with him and what he overcame was just very helpful to me.
And you'll hear about an effort to garner votes and preserve Social Security in honor of First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Karen Chase chronicles her childhood with polio and talks about the 1950s polio outbreak in the U.S. as part of her memoir, Polio Boulevard. Her book comes during the same year our nation marked the 60th anniversary of Dr. Jonas Salk's polio vaccine. Her book also comes on the heels of the September PBS broadcast of a documentary on the Roosevelts by Ken Burns.
You know, this is my fifth book, and it's my first personal book. And why I wrote it, God only knows. For some reason, polio suddenly loomed really large as a subject to write about. And, you know, art being what it is, it just emerges. I just kind of tag along and followed it. I really have avoided thinking about my illness for all these many decades. And I guess it was just a story I was ready to tell. It takes some people a very long time to tell a personal story, and I guess I'm one of those people. I was 10 years old when I got polio, and it was before the Salk vaccine was invented. I was on the polio ward playing Monopoly with a bunch of other kids who had polio, and the radio was on, and they announced over the radio that this doctor from Pittsburgh had invented a vaccine to prevent polio.
Do you remember having a reaction to that news?
You know, it was interesting. I think each of the kids sitting around there or lying around, some of us were on stretchers, some of us were in wheelchairs. People reacted differently. People made jokes. People said it's too late for us. People got very quiet.
What about you?
I think I made jokes. I think I probably made jokes.
And Karen, would you describe for us the extent to which you were immobilized, the extent of your disability?
When I first got sick, I couldn't move at all. I was paralyzed. I was in an iron lung for a short time. I slowly was able to move. I couldn't walk. I was in a wheelchair. Eventually, I could walk. Then a couple of years later, I was put in a full-length body cast and had a spinal fusion. And when I was done with the cast, I came out and I could walk, and the spinal fusion was successful, and I went back to school.
What about Franklin Delano Roosevelt? Obviously, you find some similarity here, some fascination. I'll let you describe what it is. When did you first learn of FDR's plight with polio, and what is your fascination with it? I understand you are writing about him for your next project.
Right. I think that I was aware of him before I got sick because my parents were lefty liberals who adored Roosevelt, and there were always books about him around our house. And then once I got polio, he really became a figure to me like a family member. I think he was a great person to identify with in a certain way. You know, he was so brave. He was so active. He was indomitable. He was fun-loving. Like so many people who had polio, he's a huge figure to us. To be honest, I've always felt he was my grandfather.
Why?
Because of a feeling of such strong kinship. Maybe better said, I wanted him to be my grandfather.
I'm assuming the kinship was not solely because of polio, but the fact that he had polio and what surrounded that. Who he was in spite of and because of that.
Certainly. Before he got polio, he was governor of New York. And then after he was sick, he really withdrew from politics. Then he came back full force with a strong desire to be a major figure in the world, and he accomplished that. So to identify with him and what he overcame was just very helpful to me.
So this fascination with him that started very early on for you, as you explained with having books around the house and your parents' fascination with him, how did it manifest in you? Were you reading all you could about him? Were you putting up pictures? How did it come out through you?
No, I wasn't reading about him at that point when I was young. I was just aware of him as a figure. I didn't have pictures of him around. However, I recently found a picture that I took of his grave at Hyde Park the year after I got out of the cast. And I have no memory of the trip to Hyde Park then, but obviously something was gelling in me towards him at that time.
Have you been back to Hyde Park since?
I've been to Hyde Park many times. I actually was a visiting writer there in the fall working on my new project, which is based solely on Roosevelt.
Can you talk a bit more about this?
After he had polio, a few years later, he bought a houseboat called the Larucco, and he spent 3 winters on the houseboat in the Florida Keys. During that time, he kept a nautical log, a handwritten nautical log, keeping track of the fish he caught, the guests that were there, the meals they had. And he had withdrawn from politics at that time. It was before he reentered politics. And this new project focuses on that period and the log.
What about your view on immunization? Because that has been a controversial topic for the past, I would say, at least decade,
yeah.
Whether to immunize or not. What do you think about this?
Well, I've been sort of peripherally aware of that controversy, and what goes through my head is that parents of children today who are grappling with this issue can't really imagine what it's like to be in the midst of a terrifying epidemic. And, you know, perhaps if they're reading it, like about what's happening with the Ebola virus in West Africa now, they get some sense of it. But I think it's very hard for someone to imagine the terror that was just rife in the culture when I was little before the Salk vaccine.
And certainly polio has hit the headlines since, more recently, as recurring. And when you see this elsewhere in the world, what does that do to you?
It makes me very sad to think that little children in Pakistan and Nigeria and places where polio is surfacing now, it could be avoided because of the vaccines that are available. So India is actually a great example of a country that had a lot of polio and there were internal efforts of the government, and then the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the World Health Organization and the Rotary Club collaborated, I think, with the Indian government, and there's no more polio since, I think, 2013 in India. One of the things I hope that this memoir makes clear is how important it is not to be defined by your illness. I am what I am.
She says poetically. Karen, how did you feel when the book was finished?
Nervous, I think. Excited. I felt satisfied that I had waited so long, and I don't think I could have written this book had I not written a lot of other things first.
Why Polio Boulevard? What prompted Boulevard?
Boulevards are big and wide and full of life. And when I was sick, life continued. It was not my life didn't feel completely dominated by my immobility and illness. I still had fun. That, of course, that's only one side of it, of course. But it was a boulevard. A lot was happening. You know, this gets back to what I was saying about going from being a little girl to a teenager. I was turning into a sexual teenager in the cast, you know. That can be fun.
How so, Karen?
You'll have to read the book.
The book is Polio Boulevard from the State University of New York Press. You've been listening to author Karen Chase. She resides in the Berkshires in western Massachusetts.
When our only pension check comes to our door, dear old grandma won't be lonesome anymore. She'll be waiting at the gate every night. She'll have a date when her only pension check comes to her door.
In August 1935, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act. Now, a nonprofit, nonpartisan national seniors group has launched an initiative it hopes will mobilize women voters in the November 2014 elections, as well as during the 2016 elections, a presidential election year. Max Richman is president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. He recently announced the launch of Eleanor's Hope, in honor of Eleanor Roosevelt.
Our goal with this project is to mobilize women of all ages to advocate for income equality, retirement security, and health protection equal to their male counterparts.
He and others say the fight for women's rights includes voting for candidates who represent the best interest in women's health and retirement security issues. Richman says women have a lot at stake in November's election and beyond, as the differences in policy choices offered by candidates are stark. James Roosevelt Jr. is president and CEO of Tufts Health Plan in Massachusetts. He's also the son of the founder of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, former Congressman James Roosevelt, and he is Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt's grandson.
I would just like to remember that my grandmother, who I had the chance to know because she lived until I was a senior in high school, was such a strong supporter of Social Security. Her good friend, Secretary of Labor Frances Perkins, the first woman to serve in a president's cabinet, and the only person to serve in the cabinet in all four terms of my grandfather's administration. My grandmother was a strong advocate for all Americans in need, but especially for the rights of women. She recognized that Social Security was intended to contribute to the financial well-being of almost every American family. And she lived long enough. She lived until 1962 to see Social Security begin to lift retired Americans, including retired women, lift them out of poverty. She was an activist for women's equity, for the prevention of poverty, as well as the support of those who had been in poverty. And she was an activist on many social issues, growing out of her boundless optimism that the American people could move mountains if they were only freed from the fear of want and destitution. One of the four freedoms that my grandfather outlined in his famous address in 1940. Her hope is still not fully realized for too many Americans. I believe that this Eleanor's Hope Initiative will help to change that. And the reason I emphasize change is that many people don't realize that Social Security has been amended 10 times since it was created to expand it and adapt it to changing economic conditions. Certainly the role of women in the economy is different now than it was in 1935 when Social Security was first adopted. But Social Security itself initially excluded many professions such as agriculture and domestic help and even municipal workers such as teachers. And it was expanded to include these areas, although many teachers, because of an opt-out provision for local governments, still are not covered by Social Security. The last major amendments to Social Security were in 1983, however, because that was a great compromise between President Reagan and House Speaker Tip O'Neill, who was my congressman at the time. Since then, while the baby boom generation was fully covered, the program has been frozen in gridlock like so many things, and it's time to push for change, particularly on behalf of women. My boss, when I worked at the Social Security Administration, was Deputy Commissioner for Policy, Dr. Jane Ross, a lifelong advocate for women and an expert in women's economic issues. And she captured it perfectly. Social Security is gender neutral. Life, on the other hand, is not. And Social Security needs to be adapted to lift out of poverty, in particular, women who are disproportionately affected by poverty in old age.
Democratic Senator from Massachusetts Elizabeth Warren is another who supports Eleanor's hope.
Social Security makes a huge difference for all older Americans, but there are many ways in which it has a particularly strong impact for women. As Jim noted, the world is different for women. Women live longer than men on average, so it's important to make sure there's a safety net that will help them throughout their retirement years if they outlive their other retirement savings. For 9 million women, nearly half of women age 65 or older, Social Security is the only thing standing between them and poverty. Two-thirds of beneficiaries over the age of 85 are women. Nearly half of elderly unmarried women rely on Social Security for 90% or more of their income. Women continue to earn 77 cents on the dollar, and in part because of this, they generally have lower pension benefits and receive about $4,000 a year less in Social Security benefits because the benefits are tied to how much people earn when they are working. The average annual Social Security income in 2012 was $12,520 for women and $16,398 for men. We know that Social Security works and that it is a lifetime, that it is a lifeline for seniors. It's a promise we've made that says that after a lifetime of work, everyone has a right to retire with dignity.
Terry O'Neill is president of NOW, the National Organization for Women. She builds upon the pay equity theme addressed by Senator Warren, who mentioned that women on average are paid 77 cents for every dollar earned by a man.
But for women of color, the picture is really stark. African-American women are currently being paid about 64 cents to the dollar paid to white males. For Latinas, the number is more like 59 cents. So a couple of questions arise right away. Where is this coming from, and what does it mean to the women and their families that are laboring under this unjust gender wage inequality? Well, for one thing, where it comes from is there's a number of sources, but one of the things that impacts women's lower wages is that women tend to cluster in lower wage occupations, service industries, waiting tables, anything that ends with care, child care, elder care, health care. Those professions tend to pay less for women, and so that's part of the wage gap. Another part of the wage gap is that women, much more than men, are forced out of the paid labor force in order to stay home and take care of family members. Maybe it's children, maybe it's elders, maybe it's an ill family member. But this happens more to women than to men, and it happens at lower income, not higher income. Because a woman's income is, because of the gender wage gap, her income is very often not enough for her to be able to afford caring services for family members. Over half of women in the United States today are an essential support of their family's financial welfare. What that means is if she gets laid off, it's 60 days and they're not able to pay the rent or pay the mortgage. That's how important her paycheck is to the entire family. Fully 40% of households in the United States rely on women as either the sole breadwinner or the primary breadwinner in that family. And yet, because of the gender wage gap, those families, the women and their families, are losing between $400,000 and $2 million in income that they should have gotten but for the gender wage gap throughout their working years. As women enter into their retirement years, their financial security is precarious. So expanding Social Security benefits is a key part of remedying this outrageous injustice in wages that is going on in this country.
Pay equity is part of House Democrats' economic agenda. When women succeed, America succeeds. In fact, there was a Women Succeed tour this year with events held across the country. In the case of Social Security, the mainly Democratic voices who aim for protection and expansion are coming up against mainly Republican voices who want to overhaul or reform Social Security, including by privatizing it and/or raising the minimum age. Democratic Congresswoman from Wisconsin, Gwen Moore, in March 2013 introduced the Social Security Enhancement and Protection Act.
It is really perplexing to me why seniors, by great margins, vote for people who want to cut Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. Why are we having such a difficult time communicating the dire situation that seniors will be in if we don't preserve the safety net?
She says much evidence points to the following.
We know that women rely on Social Security more than men do. We know that families depend on women's incomes these days more than ever, and that going forward, if we don't preserve Social Security, not only are women going to disproportionately suffer, but to the extent that they're heads of households, their families are going to suffer.
Again, the initiative from the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare is Eleanor's Hope, named in honor of First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, to raise awareness, recruit and train new activists, and bolster congressional leaders who the committee believes are making a difference on women's health and retirement security issues. And that's our show for this week. We hope you join us for the next one. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1318.